Hey guys, today we're talking with Vincent Bevins. He's a journalist and author. His latest book is called If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. It's really good. Both Arwa and I are fans of his work in general. His last book, his first book called The Jakarta Method, is an awesome book about U.S. interventions abroad centered on Indonesia in the 1960s. His new book that we're going to discuss today is about the much more modern era. He took some time traveling to a ridiculous number of countries. We're going to ask him about that. Traveling around to understand what exactly happened from the period of around 2010 to 2020 when mass protests broke out in different countries across the world. So he ties them all together in his book and tries to try to give us a sense of what the hell was going on. So with that said, thank you, Vincent, for taking some time to talk with us today.
Hi, Vincent.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Can you first give us a sense of the scope of the book? Can you tell us a little bit about what was the big question that you were trying to answer when you began this incredibly ambitious project?
It is ambitious. So what I did is I set myself a task which is necessarily impossible. You can never do it fully, and you can never do it fully correctly. But what I try to do is to tell the history of the world from 2010 to 2020. But obviously, you can't do that. I tried to build a history around one very specific phenomenon, which I think really drove a lot of events in the 2010s, which is mass protests that got so big they either overthrew or fundamentally destabilized countries. So I try to build a history of the world as if that's the most important thing that happened in the 2010s. And I think it makes as much sense to claim that that is the most important thing that happened as anything else, right? So like any work of history, I have to include and exclude based around a central concern. And the whole history is built around that phenomenon. And it's built around a mysterious but important question, which is how is it that so many of those mass protests apparently led to the opposite of what they asked for? So to carry that out, to make this attempt at this first draft of history, of this very important but I think confounding set of phenomena, I spent 4 years doing 250 interviews in 12 countries. So I tried to talk to the people that were either at the very beginning of these mass protests, that organized or put together the things that became the explosions, people that lived through them, the governments that tried to or had to respond to them in some way, and then everybody, wherever they are now, looking back. I asked them to tell me what they thought happened, what they wish had gone differently, what they think they learned, and how they answered that question themselves. How is it that so many of these mass uprisings didn't lead to what they asked for, even led to the opposite?
Yeah, and often it's the case that they get an even more repressive regime than the one they're trying to overturn. So it's not even just the opposite, it's just much worse.
So for the sake of the audience, what were the countries you looked at for the book?
Yeah, so I did 10 to 13, I outlined 13 cases, and I ultimately decided that 10 of them were actually the type of mass protest event that I think is, that I chose to analyze. So that's Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, Turkey, Brazil, Ukraine, Hong Kong, South Korea, Chile. So you have the first wave, the so-called Arab Spring in North Africa in 2011. You have wave two, where you have three quite strangely similar uprisings in Turkey, Brazil, and Ukraine. So like wave two is 2013. And then you get Hong Kong in 2014. I also talk briefly about Libya and Syria, but I kind of decide that it is not actually the same dynamic as Egypt or Tunisia, where it is a protest that gets large enough to really drive things. It ends up being a military conflict pretty early. And then I also talk about Indonesia, but again, which is an important part of the book in 2016, but doesn't overthrow or destabilize that country. So that's what it is. And then the decade rounds out with really the pandemic. And this is forgotten because the news cycle in late 2019 and early 2020, understandably, is all about the impending COVID-19. A pandemic, like what's happening with this virus. But as the decade ends, you had huge explosions all over North Africa, Latin America, and many other parts of the world. But I end the book on Chile and South Korea. So those are the final two cases.
Was there something like uniting all the protests that was happening at this time in the world that triggered all of them, some kind of common factor that explains why they were happening then?
So that is something that is a hard question to answer. And attempts are made. And when those attempts are made, I think some theories end up being more credible than others. But you really are kind of doing it afterwards. So a really common story is that all of this is a reaction to the 2008 financial crisis, the decimation of many countries under neoliberalism, and the failure of representative elites to respond to the crisis in the right way. I think that's part of the story. I think that's a coherent answer. Another part of the story, which I think is overstated, is that it's all about social media. So I think social media is a part of the story. So in every case that I chose, as I said, the protests got so big that they either overthrew or fundamentally destabilized a government. And when that happens, you have to have more than just two causes. You have to have 5, 6, 7 causes. So I would add those as the deep background to a lot of them. The crisis of representation in global politics, the feeling, which is more true in certain places than it is in others, that the governments that are supposed to represent the people don't. And so mass protest becomes an obvious response to that. But then in each individual case, you have to look at the local causes that interact with those other three to add up to 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You might have elites are fighting amongst themselves. You might have a case of viral repression. This is very common. A case of police brutality that acts as a trigger. You might get a case of a leader responding in a very stupid way to a small set of protests, causing them to get much bigger. So there's always a lot of answers, but those first three are the ones that are common, I think, across the decade. And one thing that we see in the 2010s is some parts, and this is common in other periods of revolutionary outbursts throughout history, is you see countries being inspired by things that happened in other places and even copying what they were doing. So you get like a certain response to real problems being kind of copied and pasted around the world very quickly, even in circumstances where the conditions were really different. And then often you got the media, who play a really big role, I think, in making any protest effective or ineffective, often looking at one country, and because it like at first glance looks like this other one, being interpreted as if it's the exact same thing, even though the actual real reasons for the revolt are very, very different. And, you know, this might be a democracy where this is a dictatorship. This might be a country which is quite rich, whereas this is one that's quite poor. So you have this weird overlap of a lot of commonalities, but also a lot of differences that are ignored at times, which I think in ways that become important.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Can you give us an example of that, like of one of the countries you studied or looked into, like where the actual result was distorted in the way that you're talking about?
Yeah, so Takrir is really the main one here. You could, if you wanted to, you could. I mean, my focus in the book ends up being more on Brazil than any other country, because this is where I lived from 2010 to 2016. This is the case that I know best. But you could really call this the Takrir decade, right? Like you could really call this the decade in which the images coming out of Cairo in late 2011 and early 2012 are so inspiring, and I think undeniably inspiring, that you get attempts to create this all around the world. But this starts even before that, right? Because in Tunisia, in late 2010, you get an uprising which proceeds along a trajectory which is a little bit easier to differentiate the actors. Like, okay, you have this union that joins the revolt. You have this civil society group that joins the revolt. You have this political party that's doing this, this political party that's doing that. And of course, I think that is one of many things, you probably would come up with more, but the example of Tunisia is added into this mix of 3, 4, 5 other things that makes January 25th happen, that makes January 28th happen, right? Is the in addition to social media, in addition to all the problems that have been happening in the country, the inspiration of Tunisia is one more that adds to this mix. But then after, when you get the square, when you get the whole world looking at what's happening, in the center of Cairo. This inspires quite a lot of other people in other countries to try to do the exact same thing. So the most famous one in the United States is Occupy Wall Street, which is Adbusters magazine, which is like a magazine that I remember from the 90s and the 2000s, the days of the ultra-globalization movement. They're trying to do Tahrir Square in New York. Like, that's explicitly the goal, which, like, you know, the inspiration of Egypt is obvious. Like I said, it's like so easy to understand why this is such a powerful image. But like, if you think exactly about the US political system, it's like, well, would you want like the military to overthrow Obama and then promise to do new elections? You know, like that was the outcome in Egypt. Like, would you want essentially the military to seize power and then say, okay, just trust us, we're going to do a better job? I think in Egypt, a lot of people celebrated as better than what had come before. In the US, this was strange. But then this goes on and on and on. And what I find is really interesting, and as you go further into the decade, you still get this process of copying and pasting after the Sisi coup, after things don't go the way that people wanted them to in 2011. In 2014 in Hong Kong, you get the Occupy Central movement, what ends up becoming called the Umbrella Movement. But this is an attempt to copy Occupy Wall Street, which was a copy of Tahrir Square, which was inspired by Tunisia. And when this happens in 2014, it's already clear that 2011 didn't go the way that the original organizers wanted it to be. But yet this process of repetition keeps happening. And I think part of this can be blamed on people like in my class, foreign correspondents in the big global media that show up, broadcast the euphoric images, don't explain really what's happening. And often even Tahrir Square itself was interpreted, I think, in strange ways by people in my class as if it was the fall of the Berlin Wall. You got this narrative all the time. Oh, it's like it's fall of the Berlin Wall, just because there's a lot of crowds in the street, right? Just because that means it's the same thing. But then they go away. Then you don't get the global media actually really explaining what happens in the long term. You get the shining, inspiring example that continues to serve as an example deep, you know, further and further into the decade, even after it didn't work, or in cases like Brazil, which I lived through in 2013, some commentators called the mass protests in Brazil, you know, the Brazilian Spring. But this was really strange. They didn't know what to do with this energy in the streets because there was a democratically elected, very popular president. And so if you take this to its logical conclusion, then you have to overthrow her, which they did 3 years later. And it was quite traumatic in the Brazilian context. So really, yeah. Really a different way to write this book if I were more knowledgeable in the Arab, on the Arab world and spoke Arabic would be to call it the Tahrir Decade.
So what actually happened in Brazil?
Yeah, it's a really strange and tragic story. Like, it's really, really weird what happens. And the weirdness of that story is what drove my interest in this topic in general. Like, I lived through it very close. I mean, I was hitting the repression, whatever, I don't care. But I was like in the crackdown that caused the explosion. There's tear gas outside of my apartment for all of 2013. And just like many other people that lived through it, what happened over the next few years, like, made no sense. It makes no sense. How was it possible that in early June 2013, a group of dedicated, hardworking, idealistic leftists and anarchists put together a protest against the rise in the bus fare? How is it that by the end of the month, millions of people join their struggle, millions of people enter the streets behind them, but then just a few days later after that, the beginning of a far-right movement actually throws them out of the streets? How is that possible? And then how is it possible that movements born in June 2013, groups that formed in that weird pressure cooker of June 2013, end up pretending to be, I mean, this is something that, I don't know if you agree, this is something that kind of reminded me a little bit of what happens before June 2013 in Egypt, is that you get groups pretending to be the same kind of deal. You get a group that emerges that is actually receiving financing from outside of the country, but pretends to be the same kind of a grassroots, idealistic, youth-led revolutionary movement. And they put together a new protest movement that is calling for the impeachment of the president. They put a new protest movement that pretends to be all the things that the first one was, but it wasn't. And this, one of the things that really reminded me of June 2013, and I don't, and you'll tell me how much this, you find this convincing, is that with this new protest movement that was pretending to be grassroots and revolutionary, people entered the streets and it's like, oh no, like the cops aren't fighting us. The cops are like with us. The like everyone's with the protests. Like the military's with the protests. The media's with, what's going on? And then that, what actually happens is they remove the president.
Yeah, exactly. And then you find out later that it was funded by some foreign power.
Yeah, which is precisely the case with, how do you pronounce it? Tamarod? What is it?
Yeah, exactly. Tamarod. Yeah. It was funded by the UAE.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, so this was something that I found that was quite the, that analog between, that analogy between Brazil and Egypt was quite fascinating to me, because we found out way later, that the group that formed in June 2013 as an intentional copy of the original anarchists and leftists. The original anarchists and leftists group is called MPL. The group that was formed in there at this, like right afterwards, like they realize, oh, the whole country loves this thing, this big protest thing. The whole country loves the MPL. So they formed a group called the MBL. And in Brazil, they only, it was only discovered much, much later. Not only did this group receive funding, in this case from the United States, of course, Tamara, it was the UAE, that the Lava Jato anti-corruption crusade, which also grew out of this strange explosion in 2013, had been working behind the scenes with the US government the whole time. And ultimately, after the removal of Dilma Rousseff in 2016, a lot of these actors join a new, more extreme far-right movement and end up helping to elect Jair Bolsonaro in 2018 and actually entering the government. So that, I'm happy to go into like how that flip happened in June, because it was like day to day, hour to hour, things just became very strange. And I think media had a lot to do with it without even really trying to, which was a really another strange thing, is that even though powerful forces took advantage of what exploded, I don't think anybody knew what they were doing while it was unfolding. But
just like June 2013.
Yeah, I mean, people told me in people told me in June 2013 in Egypt that they didn't exactly know, or they were surprised by what they ended up having taken part in. Like, oh, I thought I was taking part in this, and it turned out that I was taking part in that.
Yeah, so I'd be super curious to know whether the U.S. knew that Egypt was preparing for a coup, or the military was, before June 2013, or even greenlit it. Because we know that the U.S. and Egyptian militaries have very close ties. So that, for me, would be the big thing that we'd still want to know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a big question. So like a lot of what happens in the book is that initially successful movements, revolutionary movements or uprisings, face like an imperialist counterattack. And sometimes that imperialist counterattack is like really obvious. Like Saudi Arabia crushes Bahrain's uprising. They drive over the bridge and they crush Bahrain's uprising. And in other cases, it comes more slowly, and the foreign funding or the foreign support for whatever's happening only becomes clear later, or it's more subtle. And so I think, yeah, this is a big question. I don't know the answer. I'm really interested to know, okay, to what extent did the US government know in May 2013 what the Gulf states were cooking, what they were pushing for? Did they know that they were probably pushing for that, and then they decided that that would be, that they were going to go along with it? Or did they find out that they were pushing for it and decide, well, if it's, that's what we're going to get, that's what we're going to get? Because that's the official narrative eventually, right? Is that after the actual Sisi coup that the Obama administration goes, well, you know, this new government promises to be good on fighting Islamism, right? Which is often even like also about like a government that will not support, like that will not be pro-Palestine, right? That will play the traditional role post Camp David of a Egyptian ruler that plays by the rules of Israel and U.S. hegemony in the region. And so yeah, I think that's really interesting. Like, because you know, the CIA note, like, even when you're not accusing the CIA of being an agency that plots behind the scenes, which they always have been, they are quite good at like collecting intelligence. That's what they're supposed to be doing. So I think I'm not an expert on this, and I looked hard to try to find who are the people that really have the best evidence. And I think it's not clear yet. I mean, but those are big questions, I think.
At the very least, like we do know that the Obama administration basically supported to some degree what was going on with the coup in 2013, because right afterwards they refused to use the word coup, because if they did, they would have to cut U.S. aid to Egypt. So they basically just danced around the issue and let it happen.
Oh yeah, they ultimately went along with it. So like, that's even the official narrative, is that it happens and they're like, oh, I don't know, I guess we'll go along with it. The other question is, well, did they know beforehand? Did they say, okay, yes, you can do this? Because Gulf states, as far as I know, have, just like Israel, have at some points in recent history done things without the U.S. really wanting them to. And then the U.S. goes, oh, I guess we'll go along with that. They're, you know, whatever, right? But I'd be interested to know who knew what was planned in May 2013, and how much there was sort of a green light given, or because, you know, the traditional U.S. allies won, right? Like, you know, even though the U.S. government always supports, in theory, in general, democracy, more concretely, it has supported U.S. and Israel, or the U.S. has supported Saudi and Israeli power in the Middle East since, you know, the 60s. So, yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. In Brazil, what happens, which is really interesting, is that in June 2013, the Brazilian government believes, because the Brazilian government, Dilma Rousseff is somebody that came up in the struggle against the dictatorship. She used to be a dissident. She used to be a revolutionary. She was tortured by the dictatorship. She believes in protest. She believes in trying to give the people what they want, right? She gets a call from Erdogan in Turkey, who has his own Gezi Park uprising, and Erdogan says, we're all the victims of foreign intervention right now. There's a push around the world to destabilize and topple. And Dilma's like, nah, come on. No, the people want more, and it's their right to want more. I'm going to give it to them. By the end of the decade, by the end of the book, she comes to a different conclusion. She's like, well, I don't know exactly what was happening, but I do believe that in that moment, there was the beginning of an ultimately foreign-backed movement to remove, or a foreign-backed movement that resulted in my removal and a coup. And I think a lot of the stuff in Brazil, it is more reactive. Like, I think June 2013 explodes in a way that really nobody could understand. No one could predict. But then when it does explode, the groups that are already there, that are already relatively well-financed, that already kind of know how to play this game, they're willing to rush into the vacuum. They're willing to rush into the chaos and to try to shape it according to their will. And then the original punks and anarchists don't believe in shaping reality according to their will. They believe that they're supposed to cause the revolt and then go away. They don't believe in leadership. And the groups that are already well prepared, some being funded by Brazilian elites, some being funded by US think tanks, they end up kind of, I think, winning the battle to define what's happening on the streets in June 2013. And then they like actually throw the original organizers off the street.
So as you mentioned, in the case of Brazil, that there was US financing involved. So what did that look like? What was the nature of that financing?
So it was, so the group that the original group, the MPL, was fully autonomous, fully grassroots, fully like, they acted really on their own. And then the group that was formed in June 2013, after everything kicked off, after the whole country started to love the MPL, the MBL was receiving funding from libertarian right-wing think tanks based in the United States. So not the U.S. government, affiliates of the Atlas Network, which is this global network of right-wing think tanks. And one of the kids had done a training program under the Koch brothers, you know, who were famously responsible for like funding Tea Party protests back in the US. So it was in the States. And then one of the things that emerged out of the June 2013 protests is a focus on corruption, which is, of course, a problem almost everywhere, especially in the Global South, but really actually everywhere. But the question is, how are you actually going to combat corruption? And the very specific way that corruption was combated from 2013 to 2018 was this this operation called Lava Jato, which presented itself as apolitical, presented itself as very heroically standing up to corruption. But we found out later two things. After Jair Bolsonaro was elected, the most extreme right president in the democratic world at the time, after he's elected, the major figures in the Lava Jato or car wash anti-corruption crusade reveal themselves to actually be political actors. The whole time they're like, "Oh, I'm apolitical." The main guy joins the far right government. He reveals that he is also on the far right, and then we find out soon afterwards that these guys had been working behind the scenes with the U.S. government the whole time, the State Department and the Justice Department. Now, the Justice Department and the FBI. Are the Justice Department and the FBI working behind the scenes because for a particular ideological or geopolitical reason? Or are they just like, they just believe that they're helping to fight corruption in Brazil? We don't know. Lula speculates that they wanted to crush, that the United States government wanted to crush powerful Brazilian firms that were posing a problem to U.S. economic interests around the world. But we do know that behind the scenes, and we find out later, the Lava Jato anti-corruption crusade, which has now been revealed to be incredibly corrupt itself. Like, they broke all kinds of laws. The Supreme Court has thrown out the ruling against Lula. The Supreme Court has ruled that this main judge acted impartially, which, like, in judicial language, that means, like, that's quite a bad thing to do when you're a judge, right? He failed to act impartially, which means that he was pushing for his own. So it's all been proven that they were actually quite corrupt themselves, but that movement did interact with the U.S. government. So these are ways that, like, subtly you get the counterattack to these mass protest explosions that come in ways which are less visible than, for example, like Libya, where NATO bombs the country, or Bahrain, where Saudi Arabia comes over the bridge.
Oh, so given that you looked at all these different cases, which ones for you, or is there one that still has the biggest question marks over it, in the sense that we still don't really know what actually happened, or whether there was a much bigger foreign component to local protests or the outcome than we know now? What for you, where are the big question marks still?
No, that's a really good question. There are cases that, you know, the criterion that I employed for choosing the cases in this book is purely quantitative. Like, I didn't pick them based on how real they are, or how much I like the politics of the movement, or how much I think that they were inspiring, etc. I just chose them based on how big they got. So the ones that got big enough to fundamentally destabilize an existing government or overthrow it, that's it. So there are a couple of cases where we know that people that were there either the whole time, that were fundamental to the thing from the very beginning, not responding, but actually there from the very beginning, were getting foreign funding. That's Ukraine and Hong Kong. And that's not like a conspiracy. Like, I talked to those people about this. You know, the people in Ukraine said, yeah, you know, we were funded by either Soros or Western-backed NGOs, or our NGOs get Western funding, and, like, we wish we didn't have to, but, you know, that's how these things work. So a lot of the first people on the street in Ukraine in 2013 were getting money from the West, but then a lot of other normal people joined the protests. And then in Hong Kong, we do know about NED funding for this one labor union. There's two labor unions in Hong Kong, like, one's pro-Beijing, one's more pro-autonomy or democracy. And so, again, we know that they got funding. So that those things aren't really mysteries as much as they are just parts of the story. And, like, again, I asked the people, like, oh, is that true? Like, yeah, we did. Some people in Hong Kong say it was a mistake to take that money. Some people in Hong Kong say, well, it's all right, et cetera. But what is more interesting is in Hong Kong is that a lot of the actual organizers, a lot of the people who put together the first big rallies, which, you know, like a lot of countries, things change, but the media treats it like it's all one thing. In Hong Kong, you get, like, some really big marches in the middle of the country. You get some really big marches in the middle of the year, which demonstrate there's quite a lot of people that are behind whatever this particular cause is at this moment. But then you get things going on in a more radical and decentralized and diffuse way, which a lot of people withdraw support for. They think it either goes too far or changes the focus. But anyways, what I find interesting is that a lot of the people that I spoke to that put together these big popular initial marches came to the conclusion in 2021, 2022, as we're doing interviews, that actually the U.S. used us. We were kind of tricked by the U.S. The U.S. didn't care about us winning. They cared about screwing with Beijing. And we were, whether we knew it or not at the time, we were under illusions about what the U.S. was trying to do. And then I went back to one of these guys and I said, I was just like doing all the fact checking because we had, you know, peer review fact checking on this book. Like I said, like it's really ambitious and like there's going to be failures, but I wanted to get as right as possible. So I went back and fact checking in Ukraine and I told one of this main, I showed the quotes back to one of these main Hong Kong organizers and he's like, oh, I do believe that, but I can't believe I told you that. I didn't know that I was that honest with you. Like that was something that I'd kept to myself. I do think that now, but I didn't know that I had gone public with that thought. So I think in every case, but in every single case, and I say this at the end of the book, you know, this is the nature, ironically, it's the nature of the really imperfect global system that we do have, that big, powerful, self-interested states do bad stuff secretly. And it's the, you know, it's what we have to deal with as journalists or historians or whatever in this particular kind of imperfect system that we're not going to find out the full truth until later. So I look forward to being surprised and shocked, or maybe not surprised, but still shocked by revelations in the future. But that's what you get when you have a world of often imperialist, self-interested states that use covert action as a matter of course.
Yeah, and you can even interpret the Egyptian Revolution in 2011 as a sort of rejection of the Western neoliberal policies, because Mubarak really was the Arab face of a lot of these policies. He, you know, under Mubarak, there was more, in the 2000s particularly, there was more privatization deals than anywhere else in the Middle East. And so, you know, Egypt really was a sort of darling of the IMF and the World Bank and the whole Washington consensus. So when people go out and protest calling for, you know, bread, freedom and social justice, this really was a rejection of those policies, even though that's not how the revolution was framed when it was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the only thing I would add that makes it even more in your face is the other storyline that was going on in the 2011 protest, which was just that there was this rejection of Gamal Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak's son, taking over. And he really was the face of neoliberal policies. He's an investment banker involved in private equity in the 2000s and, you know, a regular World Economic Forum attendee type. So the fact that the protests were also rejecting this is another element of it being a rejection of neoliberalism.
So can you tell us a little more about the role that the media played in distorting the narrative during the protests in places like Egypt and Brazil?
Yeah, great. And that's good. I'm glad you asked that because that allows me to finish actually answering the first question that you asked that I didn't really finish. So I already outlined the big story in Brazil, but I'll do this little bit that I left out before. On the morning of June 13th, 2013, Brazil's mainstream media, which is all oligarch-owned, perhaps liberal on social issues, but center-right on economic issues, they demanded a police crackdown. They said that the military police need to get out there and get these kids off the streets. Now, Brazilian journalists in the big mainstream outlets are not from the part of society that usually actually receives the violence of police repression. And police in Brazil are military police, and that's a legacy of the US-backed dictatorship. So when the crackdown comes, it really shocks them. And when the crackdown comes, it hits people like me and people that work in the Brazilian mainstream media. It hits white, middle-class journalists, photogenic young women, who, in a way which is probably reminiscent of the North African uprisings, become kind of the face of the thing for a couple of days. It's like, this was that person who's in, you know, if you look really, really closely, you know, the degree to which these are innocent, perfect representatives of the country kind of is like, doesn't make perfect sense all the time. But there is the image of a young Italian Brazilian woman who almost loses her eye that goes viral. And this really shocks the country, not only because it's violence, but it's violence against the kind of person that usually doesn't get repressed in Brazil. So from the morning to the evening of that day, Brazilian media flip their narrative. They go from saying, and you can watch it happen in real time. It's really strange. You could watch it happen on YouTube, like the guy realizing that the whole country is kind of changing their narrative and that this is looking really bad. You can watch them sort of like the wheels turning in their head as they come up with a new story. But from the morning to the evening, they go from saying these punks and anarchists need to be cleared off the streets to actually this is we need to defend freedom of expression. This is actually a patriotic uprising in defense of the right to rise up in defense of the freedom of expression. Like they're trying to figure out why it's good. And so between the 13th and the 17th, which is the day of the next protest, you get huge media coverage of what is the next planned protest. And you get a media which has been calling everyone these like troublemakers and punks and vandals, now saying the people are coming out to stand up to injustice or whatever. And in those 4 days, the media is not going to say the same thing as the MPL, the anarchists and punks. Like the mainstream media in Brazil isn't going to say all public transportation fees should be abolished. The revolutionary battle with the police is the beginning of an insurrection, which like obviously that can't be their reasoning. So they have their own kind of framing. They have their own reasons for why the country is rising up. They have their own reasons for why this is a good thing. And I don't think there's a conspiracy to like change the narrative, but they're just looking for something that they can say which is compatible with their worldview. And so these new narratives tend to be a little bit more center-right. They tend to be a little bit more anti-political. They tend to be a little bit more anti-corruption. They tend to be more about opposing the Workers' Party government, the center-left government, which is a government that the original protesters would have criticized and wanted to radicalize, but not overthrow with a right-wing response. So what you get, and this is really fascinating, and I watch it happen in real life, and I like it happens before my eyes, and like the transformation is really strange, is that on Monday, people show up who look really different than the people who were there 4 days before. And they're wearing, instead of like dressing like punks in black and like, you know, kind of typical, you know, left-wing protester outfits, they're wearing the Brazilian national colors. They're wearing the yellow jersey. They're wrapped in the flag. And you see this weird, like these two sides, like confronting each other and looking at each other and not knowing what to do with each other. And the original protesters say, oh, no, they're trying to help. They believe, the original protesters believe that it's their job to like bring them into this movement. They say, oh, no, actually, this is a protest about social services. If you just bring in flags and empty nationalist slogans, that's actually quite dangerous. The way that we're doing, they like started to explain like, hey guys, thanks for coming, but here's how to do, here's what you're joining. And these new guys are like, shut up. I don't care about you. You skinny left-wing punks from the poor periphery of the city. I'm here for this reason, and I don't care. I don't want a lesson from you. Shut up. And as you can see, and then that night, even though the people in the yellow and green kind of protest performance outfit, to my eyes, were only a small percentage of the people on the streets. When I got home that night and watched Globo, which is the super powerful television channel, which is like arguably responsible for, like, to the extent that Brazil is represented as like a sexy beach country, it's because of this channel. Like they're the Rio based, they make all the novellas. It's a really powerful television channel. When I get home that night, the people in the yellow and green patriotic gear, that's all they're showing. And I'm like, well, I guess they just were looking at a different part of it than I was. I only saw a few of those guys. And they were new and it was weird, but then this is all the country is seeing. And then the president goes on television soon afterwards and she interprets the protests as if the green and yellow costume is the one that is everyone's wearing, because she can't do what I'm doing, which is walk around the streets, right? She has to watch from the presidential palace. And then the next day, after those images are transmitted showing that actually this is more of a patriotic thing, the next day it actually really is. By the next day, the majority of the people are in a more patriotic gear, until by the 20th, the patriotic, more anti-political, and there's like this weird slippage where they're like, this weird confusion where the original protests were nonpartisan. The new arrivals are anti-party. So anybody that is visibly from any kind of a political tendency is like, you're not supposed to be doing that. So by the 20th, just, you know, seven days after the original crackdown, the yellow and green, bulkier, whiter, more conservative people on the streets throw out the original protesters. And again, that is one more piece of evidence for what I argue in the book, where I think like most real scholars of protest agree on, is that protests always exist in some kind of back and forth with media, like some kind of media, whether it's social media or traditional media. Like, the vast majority of people are going to find out about a protest because of some kind of media. They're not going to hear about it firsthand, you know, from someone on the streets. And it was only because of the you would have never gotten that new type of arrival with that new type of understanding without the narrative that was given to regular people that, of course, weren't there the first day. They don't know these anarchists. They're not members of their Facebook group, which is where a lot of the original invitations were extended. And so, like, that's one of the things that the conclusions I come to in the book is that the media representation of these events, of these movements, not only changed the way that the rest of the world saw them, but they actually changed the thing. They actually reconfigured the real movement. And then just to go back to Egypt, I think, like, this won't be so, I mean, maybe you'll have memories or accounts that are similar, but like what I found was that a lot of the people that had put together, that had been like really fighting behind the scenes from 2008 to 2011 to put together the protest movement, they necessarily, you know, they came often out of pro-Palestine movements. They came out of, they like got to know each other protesting the war in Iraq. They thought that necessarily this would be kind of an anti...
Yeah, exactly. And that's why like protests for Palestine are banned in a place like Egypt, because the government's worried that if they allow these kind of protests, they'll be used as a springboard for other sort of demonstrations against the state here. Yeah. So
yeah. And then a lot of those people who had been, you know, fighting for years to put together the beginnings of a protest movement were really shocked to see sort of, you like, global media show up and act like this was a pro-Western uprising. Like, this was a movement where Egypt wants to join America. Egypt wants to, like, become junior America. Whereas these people are like, no, we a real democracy in Egypt would challenge the allies of the United States in this region. With something like Tahrir Square, there was nobody in Tahrir Square that could say, let me explain to you what this is all about. You had a multiplicity of ideas of what it was all about, which was, you know, I think a strength and a weakness of the type of uprisings we saw in the 2010s.
The problem is that leftists here, like elsewhere, don't tend to have a lot of money. So they don't go to private schools. They don't speak English. So that makes it so that the foreign press often just goes to these elites to interview them, and of course they tend to have more pro-Western views.
I know the Egyptian case less well, but yeah, like, hopefully I've reproduced that, it's all based on interviews, but I think that, you know, what I can speak as is a member of the class of international correspondents that have the biggest microphone, and I think we shouldn't have the biggest microphone, and we repeatedly failed to use it responsibly, covering a lot of the mass protests that are in the book. I'm really interested to hear both of what you say on that, because, like, yeah, that last element too, because, like, early when you asked me, like, okay, well, what were the, you know, causes, and, like, each country had their own individual set of causes. That was a really important one in the Egyptian context. Like, the ruling class and the military upset with that decision to pass the country over to Mubarak's son. And this is something that, like, does come up often when there are successful revolutions, is like splits in the ruling class. And yeah, and he was like, it was like people that are definitely not on the far left that were saying that this guy is a he's a pure creature of like the worlds of Davos. Like, this is like a military position, you know, the Egyptian military is not like, you know, communist. So this dynamic was really pronounced also in Ukraine, because, like, as you said, like, the people that they can get to come on TV in Egypt tended to be people that were speaking English with a nice accent, saying nice things that would be pleasing or comforting to the viewer of CNN, rather than something like, we need to reject U.S. U.S.-backed neoliberalism and imperialism in the Arab world, right? And in the case of Ukraine, where things are a little bit more complex in the sense that the country is more divided, there is because this narrative that I'm about to explain, the group of people that I'm about to identify as being given the largest microphones, they do represent a real tendency within Ukrainian society, and they do represent a real cause around which a lot of people protested. But the people that worked in civil society in the capital of Ukraine in late 2013 tended to be liberals of the type that you would find in Berlin or New York. They kind of want the same stuff that, or even live kind of the way that someone in Berlin lives. And not only do they speak English very well, and not only do they want the same thing that a reader of The Guardian would want, they work in these very well-funded and professional organizations that have, like, they like train their people how to speak with the media. They like, they know exactly how to get the right message to the right people. They're good at what they're doing. And again, like, I'm not trying to cast aspersions on those people. Like, I know a lot of them, and like, it is relevant that a lot of them are like friends of my friends, because they come from the same social world as a lot of foreign correspondents, which means that when foreign correspondents move to Ukraine, that's who they're hanging out with. Right. And so that the things that they believe in are not like wild imperialist impositions. A lot of Ukrainians want that. But all of the other Ukrainians that don't speak English at all, live very far from the capital, maybe would have thought that Yanukovych, the president that was being overthrown, actually sucks, but they voted for him anyways because they thought that he was better than the other team. That narrative is also one that exists, but doesn't get, it's not as easy to, it has a very hard time making it onto Western media. And then it's obviously after Russia starts to infiltrate those parts of the country, they just really get ignored whatsoever, ignored entirely. And so this dynamic comes up all over the, what I call the mass protest decade, even when it seemed, even when like kind of, I think like the Egyptian revolution, like a lot of the country is behind January and February 2011, whereas Ukraine's kind of really split. And then in Brazil, it's like kind of like, it's all over the place. But yet the media, including me, I did this. Me and my friends did this. I remember in June 2013, we had this really strange explosion that wasn't led by anybody. It wasn't really about bus fees anymore. People fighting in the streets. And so our job, and this was, again, this is a task that is handed to us, which I think we don't deserve, that we play too big of a role than we should, a bigger role than we should. We had to go into the streets and come back with some kind of an explanation as to what this thing is about. And yeah, okay, I know Portuguese, I know, been in the country for long enough. But even then, I found that the answers, me and my friends, I know the other four or five correspondents that all did the same thing on the same day. I found that we all exited the streets or the squares, I think without trying to lie, really. We all came with narratives that were slightly different in ways that combined, that were compatible with our own ideological biases. So like, I was there longer. I knew about the original demands. I sort of already believed that Brazil needed better social services. So I came back having spoken to a bunch of people that did actually say that. And that was people, maybe it jumped out to me. And then other colleagues of mine that are more center right or more, they believe this or that, they come back with something that reflects their own biases. And I don't even think that they were trying to lie. I wasn't trying to lie. It's just that, like, you end up seeing what you want in an explosion, which is so difficult to interpret. And this is something that the book, many of the interviewees came to this conclusion. Many of the interviewees in Egypt, Brazil, Ukraine, Hong Kong, Chile, came to the conclusion that this particular type of response to injustice, the apparently spontaneous, leaderless, digitally coordinated, social media driven, horizontally structured mass protests, ends up relying too much on people like me to interpret it. It ends up, because there is nobody in the square that can say, well, actually, it's about this and that person over there that's doing that thing that no one agrees with, you know, don't listen to them. Because there's no one to say, there's no one that can be professing what it's about, it meaning gets imposed from the outside. So that's one part, one side of the media coin. The other side of the media coin is that journalism is really like underfunded and imperfect, and the people that are running around the world don't really know what they're doing. They're just often like rich Americans that just see what they want to see. And those things, I think, ended up in really like shaping the outcomes in a lot of countries.
So in your book, you really urge other journalists to take responsibility and be more cautious when covering an event outside of, you know, their country. And of course I agree and I respect that, but you know, can the media be reformed?
Well, this is, again, I guess it's my job to hope and that media can be better. Like, I think that journalism is really like in crisis and it's getting worse, and I hope, and I'm like, my wish is to stop that process as much as possible. But I think I sympathize with your cynicism. Like, if there was, you know, imagine, like, because again, a lot of these kind of explosions rely on the sympathetic coverage to get the word out, right? Because the flip side of this coin, like the one side of the coin is that if CNN thinks what you're doing is great, they're going to see what they want to see in the protest. The flip side of that coin is that if the media doesn't like what's going on, if the media does not sympathize with the streets, then they can also go and pick elements which are there and use that to tell the story. And this is what you saw like at the end of the George Floyd uprising in the United States, is that as things went on longer and longer, an uprising which had the support of the vast majority of the American people at the beginning, as it goes on longer and longer, more conservative outlets can find the one or two or three incidents of the craziest or stupid people out of, you know, millions and millions, and be like, that's what it's all about. See, that's what it's all about. And I think you ask a really good question. Like, how would have global media portrayed the Egyptian uprising if it was obvious what it was really about? If there was somebody that was saying, like, if there was an MLK that was saying, this is about democracy, but also about imperialism, which MLK did end up saying by the end of the 60s. And this caused quite a lot of people in the media in America to hate him and lie about him. After he was killed, they like pretended that they loved him the whole time. But when he actually connected poverty in the United States with U.S. militarism around the world, people got really mad at him and media lied about him. So I'm really, I am sympathetic to your cynicism. So I guess one answer to that question is to, one answer to that question that other people come to at the end of the book is try as much as possible. And there's no way out of this because the world is so mediatized, like we're so mediated, is to try to add forms of struggle which don't rely on CNN, because you can maybe use them as your friends for a while, but if you really, really want to do something revolutionary, they won't be your friends forever. So other forms of struggle that don't rely on representation are like union activity, strikes, boycotts, like organized concerted action on particular elites. But again, like that's easier said than done. Like anyone that was, remember, you know, Egypt in 2010, there's a reason there wasn't like strong civil society organizations that could put that kind of organized pressure, because it had been, they had been decimated, right? So it like I totally sympathize with your cynicism. Like that's there was no easy way out of the situation that most of these countries were in this decade, and that kind of explains why the revolts took the form that they did.
What's so interesting and so frustrating is that it seems like in the 2000s, you have these protests which are successful initially in overthrowing their local dictator, but there's almost this inability to do anything with that because these local forces quickly discover, or maybe they don't discover, but they're kind of thwarted by the larger global forces of imperialism.
No, I totally agree that that is a process that I think we watched play out often tragically in different countries, that an old lesson was relearned, and an old lesson that was known quite well in the 20th century is that a successful revolution that actually challenges larger power systems, that actually takes power away from elites, will engender a counter-revolution. There will be a counter-revolutionary reaction. So one conclusion that I come to at one version of the talk that I've been giving about this book at universities is that the particular form of uprising that we saw in Tahrir Square, you know, as I already said earlier, apparently leaderless, spontaneous, digitally coordinated, horizontally structured, mass protest, turned out to be way more effective than we expected at getting people in the streets and creating revolutionary situations, at creating power vacuums, at destabilizing existing elites. But it proved poorly suited to taking advantage of those power vacuums. Often you just, whoever was waiting already in the wings, whoever was already was organized and ready to move, took power. And then this particular form is really bad at defending itself against the counter-revolution that will come. Like a protest of people with different reasons for being there that don't agree about what it's all about. They don't have a structure or an organizational network that allows them to act collectively, ends up really being vulnerable to counter-revolution. So like, that's why that analogy with the Berlin Wall is so interesting, because like, if it was like the Berlin Wall, if it was just kind of East Germans saying, we give up, the West, we just want you to like pour into our country and do whatever you want here, which is not exactly what East Germans were asking for, but it's what they got. And it kind of worked out okay. You know, at least now they're German, right? But if you have a movement which is actually challenging larger power structures, if, you know, and like a democratic Egypt always will, right? Because like for a very long time, you know, the U.S. has been very afraid of the power of Arab nationalism, Arab socialism, what it means to have an anti-imperialist Egypt. I mean, U.S. support for both Israel and Saudi Arabia in the 20th century was about countering this really powerful draw of Nasserism, right? And so if you end up actually challenging larger structures, if you break out of that bubble, then there is the counterattack. And I think, yeah, the structures of that, the unjust global system that we inhabit, that will become violent if necessary to maintain itself, became visible as people broke out of that bubble or like pushed up against the real nature of it. Because people always ask me like, how does my second book relate to my first book? My first book is about like US violence, US backed violence against the left and the construction of a global system through imperialist intervention. And I often say that it's an indirect sequel, because in the first book, that system is established. And in the second book, in the beginning of each uprising, you can kind of forget that you're still living in it. But then in horrifying ways, you can start to see on the horizon, oh no, we still do live in that same system.
We really loved your first book.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, shout out to Jakarta Method. That's it's an incredibly good book. It's interesting that you call this latest book a sequel to that one.
Yeah, it's like an indirect sequel. And just to be clear, just for my own self-interested purposes. The first book is out in Arabic, but I really hope the second one can come out in Arabic. Like the people that have the best, this has like really been nice to me. It's been really, really gratifying. Cause like, I know Brazil, I don't know North Africa that well. My like chapter on 2010, 2011 is like pretty like quick. Like it's like pretty basic, but like the nicest responses that I've gotten, like the nicest emails have been people from North Africa, people who were like lived through Libya, lived through Syria, lived through Egypt. So I really hope that this one can come out in Arabic as well. If anybody knows a publisher, get in touch with me because I'm like actively looking.
Yeah, so we should take this podcast as a chance to say if there is any Arabic publishers out there who wants to take this book, it's a huge opportunity. Take it while it's hot. You should get in contact with Vincent and bring this awesome book to the Arabic language.
Did you already get it translated?
No. The way that it works is like, and this is a funny thing because like, speaking of the imperialist world system, even though this book is not about the United States and I'm not in my head, I'm not thinking about a US audience, in order to be viable, in order to stay in this world and keep writing books like this, I have to market the book in the US first. Like for like, they care so much about the US audience that I have to kind of pretend for a while that it's about like, that I'm, well, not pretend, but I have to like really promote it in the US, and only after it gets some amount of success in the US do they begin to sell translation rights to different countries around the world. But like, again, these books are not only about the imperialist world system, they also are published into the imperialist world system. So I have to do like all America promotion at first before I can get to the audiences, which I hope to connect with more, which is like audiences in other countries.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your time, Vincent. And again, we recommend your books to everybody, all our listeners.
No, I think this was great. I think this is a good like teaser, because there's so much more in the book. And as I said before we started recording, like I've been really like gratified to see people coming to me, finding things in there that I, you know, finding their own pieces of little items that jump out at them throughout the entire narrative. Because it's really put together like a history that is kind of a story. So I think we've given hopefully quite a lot of a sneak peek, and you know, any interest in actually checking out the book or getting it translated to any language in the entire world is truly appreciated. But for me, I'm really good, and I thank you for having me on and for your interest.
Yeah, go buy the book. Vincent's work is awesome. Thank you so much, man.